Power Records
yeah,
magazine.
Yeah, Mike, how you doing?
Good. Listen, I'm writing this article, as I mentioned yesterday, on the production of country music, and I wanted to ask you a few questions.
Okay, I hope I can.
Well, you know, I have a general question, and then I want to ask you specifically about some of your production work. The general question is, when you came to work as a producer, did you have a theory of production, what you thought a producer should do, what he shouldn't do, what his role was?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think that changes and has changed over the years. I guess the theory that I hold most here is that a producer should help the artist get their music on tape, and really, you know, stay out of the coloring process as much as possible. In the sense that it's the artist's music that has to be on tape, not the producer's music.
So the producer in that way becomes almost invisible or inaudible.
Yeah, I think a best producer, you know, I mean, well, I think that, and hopefully I've done this, and hopefully my work is you know, evidence of this. You know, every artist that you do should sound different.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can accomplish that, then I think hopefully you're doing the job of being invisible. But yet, you know, you're making sure that the quality of music is there, the technical part of the music, you know, of the process is there. But at the same time, you know, it's impossible to totally stay out of the process because, you know, you're in it. But I think that if a producer's music starts sounding alike and he's got five different artists, then he's being too intrusive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess like most people, I'm most familiar with your work with George Strait, mm-hmm. and Milo Mason and Keith Whitley, and your most famous work there being with George Strait.
Right.
Tell me how you got that as a, you know, got George Strait as a recording project, and mm-hmm. talk to me about working with him in the studio.
Okay, well, the way it came down was Irv Woolsey, who was head of promotion at MCA, knew George, and George had sang at a club that Irv owned down in Texas. And Irv approached me. I worked for at one time ABC, which was bought out by MCA. In fact, Irv worked for ABC Records. I worked for ABC Publishing. And so we got to know each other, and he approached me about cutting some sides on George. So that's basically how I was, you know, got involved in it initially. And we went to Texas to see him work. And at that point in time, George was basically did mostly Texas swing stuff, which was, you know, what that audience was looking for. I mean, it was kind of, I came back and said, you know, Texas is another country altogether.
Right.
And I love Texas. I mean, if I wasn't living here, I'd move to Texas. I love Texas.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't familiar with all the Texas swing music, so it was an education for me as well. And in regards to working with George is a relatively easy fella to work with. And I think that the reason obviously we parted company, and maybe that's why my philosophy is, or I'm so adamant about producers being less visible, is that I think maybe George felt that at that point in time that I might have been too visible in terms of, you know, trying to move him musically.
Trying to shape his sound.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that to some degree that George has moved, but maybe not as quick as I wanted him to move. I would be the last guy in the world to say that he was wrong about that. I think history has proven that he was right, and you know, I'm proud of the work that we did together, and I think he is too. And you know, I think we were growing at two different speeds and maybe two different directions. But we've remained friends, and Irv Woolsey and I are his manager are still friends, and
mm-hmm.
so I'm proud of what we did, and I feel like that, you know, we've made a mark on music.
Well, one of the things is, you know, the producer's in that position, a kind of an in-between position between the record company executives, or between, you know, the ledger sheets, and between the artists, and between the, and then in another way, between the artists and the audience, because you've got to hear for the audience. So it's one, you know, it's kind of one thing in hindsight to say, well, gee, you know, it'll emerge that a little less produced sound is going to take the fore in the mid to late 80s. Mm-hmm. But when you first started producing George Strait, that was at the height of a certain type of heavily produced sound, I think.
That's to give you an example, one of the songs on the charts was Bill Anderson, Still the One, mm-hmm. country disco.
Yeah.
And so we did, you know, go, you know, pretty 90 degrees to that.
Right, right.
It's a crapshoot, and when a million people drive down and buy the record, then you're right.
Yeah, right. After the fact.
Kind of that way that works.
Yeah, they weigh in at the cash register.
Yeah, and if they don't, you're wrong.
Yeah.
You can't take that personal. You just.
Yeah. Now, did you think much about what the public was? What you're saying is there was a negotiation going on there between the artist, what the public was buying at that moment, and what the record company perhaps thought they wanted.
Well, I basically brought what I thought was good songs, commercial songs,
mm-hmm.
and. That's what I still do to this day. I think my job is to go find songs that fit the artist, or maybe at least expose that song to the artist, let him decide. It might be a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a believer that the duty of artist and record company and producer or anyone and radio is to look for the edge. Now, because the edge becomes the middle, you know, real quick.
Right.
So our job, I think, is to look for the edge. And sometimes an artist doesn't feel comfortable going as close to the edge as maybe, you know, a producer might or somebody else might. And ultimately, that decision has to be the artist.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the ones that get up in front of the audience and perform. And if it doesn't work, they're the ones stuck up there for 3 minutes singing a song that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I think a producer has to be sensitive of that information, but at the same time, the artist has to be sensitive to the fact that the producer's, you know, intentions, hopefully, are to, you know, go out and sell as many records as possible.
Okay, yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when, I think sometimes an artist will feel a little, like that song is not me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought on that is, you know, if you really feel uncomfortable, then don't even think about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's a little bit of discomfort, maybe try it. Maybe stylize it. You know, I mean, Vern Gosden didn't really want to do I Can Tell By The Way You Dance.
Mm-hmm.
But it was his first number one record.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he went out and sang it one time.
Yeah.
He said it'll never be a single.
Yeah.
Well, because he didn't think, it turned out to be what he needed at the time. But when we were recording it, he was kind of thinking, I don't know if this is me or not.
Right.
You see, so it is a compromise. I think your word in a negotiation, I think you're very wise in saying what you just said, is it is a compromise between, you know, staying where you're at and also looking for the edge.
Yeah. Well, do you
sometimes
recall?
That's scary.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, because there's a lot riding on it.
Right, exactly.
The stakes are high.
That is exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, I do things that are scary, but the stakes aren't that high because I'm usually not kind of a designate in the use of other people's money.
Yeah.
Never mind. Now, do you recall the circumstances under which you cut Amarillo by Morning? That's such a beautiful song.
Well, thank you for that's kind of an interesting. George was already doing that song in his show,
because mm-hmm.
that was almost like the national anthem of Texas at the time. I believe there was a fellow by the name of Kelly Choppa had that out in Texas, and it was sort of a regional hit. It wasn't a national thing. And so we put that on as the last song of a session. We had 15 minutes left.
Mm.
And we ran it down one time and put it on tape, the second take. And we got ready to put it down on the, run it down the second time or put it on tape. Everybody says, well, how are we going to end this thing? And I said, just keep playing and I'll fade it, or if I'll figure that out, when we get finished in the mix. So what happened is we had enough time, because we just kept playing, we had enough time that I came up with the idea of start dropping instruments out and bathing the fiddle in reverb, so it would feel like that he was driving away.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And that's how that ending came on, and I'm proud to say I don't think I've ever heard a disc jockey interrupt it.
Yeah.
They always kind of leave it play to that last fiddle just finally fades away. So that was sort of one of those accidents that turned out good.
Right. Well, so what you had is you had the entire band in the studio, but they were separated, so there wasn't any bleed with tracks, so that you could.
Yeah, right. They were isolated. Some of them in booths, some of them had baffles and stuff.
Yeah.
And so we just cut the record.
Yeah.
Of course, if you don't change anything, it's okay, little bleed over's okay.
Yeah.
You'll get a little of that sometimes.
Right.
But as long as you're not changing that instrument, later.
Mm-hmm.
So that basically, that record, if I recall, it had no overdubs.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. It's just, it was a finished record when we got done, other than vocal.
Yeah. Well, actually, and it's part of this whole series of interviews I've been doing. I did talk to Tony Brown the other day and mentioned the song, and he said, man, I wish I had produced that one.
Well, that's awful nice for him to say that.
Yeah.
There was a thing in the newspaper yesterday that I saw. Or no, it wasn't either. It was in the Close-Up magazine. There was six or eight people asked what their five all-time favorite country records, they felt were standards, and two out of the eight mentioned Amarillo by Morning.
Is that right? Well, it's I think that fiddle makes a big difference too. I mean, it gives it that kind of plaintive, lonesome kind of sound as well.
Yeah, when we bathed it in reverb, the further we went, the more reverb. It just sounded like it was fading off into the distance. It kind of symbolized what the song was all about.
Yeah.
Driving away. He's going to be there by the morning.
Now, did you worry? I mean, that was an age back to, it's kind of important to think back at that time, like you were saying, what else was being produced. But did you worry a lot about, let's say, drum sound?
Just to be honest with you, this my philosophy, right or wrong, I can't tell you, I can't judge what I'm right or wrong. I've always looked at music as something that there is no right or wrong,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like fashion. What's in or out, or there's some sounds that are in, there's some are out. They change from time to time. But I always think that the job of a producer is to make sure that it sounds different,
uh-huh.
that stands out on the radio, that people reach over and maybe turn the knob up.
Yeah.
And so I've never. And I don't mean this the wrong way. I don't mean this arrogantly. I've never thought about that. I know the stakes are high, but that's never entered into my head. Maybe I'm not smart enough to figure that out. I think you go in there and you just follow your gut and do the best job and try to be different.
I see. Now, tell me about your work with Keith Whitley. And I'll wrap this thing up
okay.
So you can get back to work. I mean, sure. You got him early on, right?
Well, yeah, I got him. He had did a little album with Gnarl Wilson on RCA,
mm-hmm.
and then they asked me if I would come in and cut the next album. And the first thing we cut was a mini album. Had six sides on that. RCA was kind of experimenting with six-sided albums at that time with some of the brand new artists.
Okay, yeah.
And then the Miami thing came out, and they asked us to go back in and cut four more sides, make it a full album.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel at that moment this guy's going to really be something?
Yeah, you know, Keith had that magical quality that, first off, he was an incredibly wonderful human being. And you couldn't work with Keith without, you know, being his friend and truly caring about him. He was an incredibly talented singer, had just an incredible range. Unfortunately, as we all know, he had the disease of alcoholism.
Right.
And
was that apparent there that this was going to be a real problem?
Well, yeah, it was in a sense because it seemed like when things were going the best is when that's when Keith had the toughest time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in defense of Keith, you know, he hated the disease as much as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a disease.
Sure.
And he couldn't control it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he fought it really hard, but for some reason, you know, he just it won.
Yeah.
Sadly to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wondered, you know, when you're working with someone where you say, boy, there's tremendous potential here, but this is going to be a uphill struggle.
Well, you know, the thing about Keith was, I think other people you might have been angry at that behavior,
mm-hmm.
but with Keith, you couldn't be angry.
Uh-huh.
You know, I genuinely loved him as a human being.
Yeah.
And you just, your heart ached for him, you know, living.
Now, let me ask you one final question on producing. We'll just make it, you know, a male vocalist sort of question with both Strait and Whitley and Vern Gosden. Let's take him as an example as well. That in what cases do you say, I mean, I guess there are obvious ones, but in what cases do you say, let's do a punch in or let's do an edit here?
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach the artist on that? Can you, and if you could, give me an example.
Well, you know what I normally do, because that's a real sensitive area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the least amount of control that the producer has over the project. So what I try to do is never put the artist in an embarrassing situation. Basically, most of the time, the artist knows if he's made a mistake or he can do it better. So normally, I just call him in for a playback, and they'll tell you, or you may bring up, say, hey, listen to this first verse here or something, you know, just nonchalantly.
Yeah.
And they'll say, oh, I think I can do that better.
Okay.
You see, so you kind of let it be their decision. And, of course, today, you know, and if they can't do it better, then there's no reason to make them try.
Right.
And but, you know, today we have a lot of machines that can tune some of those areas that may or may not be right on, you know?
Yeah. Do you tend to have rules about when and when not to rely on, let's say, you know, those kind of, those tools?
I think you can become too dependent on them. I agree with that very much. And, mm-hmm. You know, obviously the ideal situation is when you know, you don't have to. But basically what I try to do is run we've got the luxury today of a lot of tracks.
Right.
So I try to give the singer, you know, five or more tracks, and we'll just run it down.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, kind of keep tabs on what you have and what you don't have. And then you can, you know, steal a word from here, a word from there, whatever.
Yeah.
And make a composite vocal, which it's not tuning, it's using the talent of the singer, but just picking the best of that singer.
Can you give me an example of a song where you would say this is a case where I think compositing worked really beautifully?
Well, geez, you know, almost every artist, that's the way we do it now.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, 90% or more,
mm-hmm.
fall in that category.
Right.
To be honest with you.
I mean, that's been a huge change in your career.
Yeah, well, you know, we've had that luxury for a few years because, you know, when we went to 24 tracks.
Right.
You know.
You can do it, but not as easily as you can with
digital.
Today,
with 32 or 48 tracks, right.
And with digital.
Yeah, that's another thing. Yeah, the punch-in is so quick nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was curious about, too, that whole shift from analog to digital and power tools and, you know, so on.
Right, Pro Tools.
Pro Tools. Power Tools, I'm thinking of Tim Allen's show.
A Black & Decker.
That's right, the Black & Decker approach to production, which might be a new...
new line.
Yeah. A new avenue.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so you're just saying that's the way things are done.
Yeah, basically, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, you know, because it is the artist's true talent, you know. I mean, you're just picking the best of the best, and that's kind of what you would do with anything, you know.
Right, I don't think, in fact, that's the way movies have been made since the beginning of the century almost.
Yeah,
you
right,
know?
And that's the way we do the musicians. You know, we may have them do a couple tracks and go over and take a little line of this or that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that fascinates me is that the naysayers on the use of the technology, I understand that there can be problems with it, but the naysayers almost forget, I think, that music has lagged a good 75 years behind filmmaking in the way this sort of post-production can be employed to make, you know, a finished artistic project.
Well, the only difference, if the only difference between the movie, say, and a record is that the movie star doesn't have to go out and duplicate his performance again once he's on tape.
That's a key point.
You see, and the artist does. So you have to be, you have to know that you have an artist that is capable of going out in front of an audience and reproducing, you know, something similar to what's on tape.
Right. In
and
fact,
that's the only difference I could see. But you know, I think you have to embrace technology because, I mean, if we didn't, we wouldn't have had movies. We wouldn't have had records. We'd had everything would have been live. You know,
right.
Stage or so. And you know, you just have to be careful not to rely too much on it.
Yeah.
If it gets in the way of maybe altering someone's ability, in other words, or enhancing their ability that they don't have.
Yeah. I mean, I think early in the about the first half of the history of recording, the artist would walk into the studio and the studio would actually document what they were already doing somewhere else.
Mm-hmm,
but
exactly.
Then there's a shift after a while, and like you're saying, the artist walks in and does something and then tours to support the recording.
Right.
And is actually having to replicate what happened in the studio.
Yeah, I think that's true. That's a good way of looking at it.
And with video, people even cheer when they see certain moves that replicate the video.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just shifted all. It's actually reversed those two components of performing. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'll let you go. I really appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you for calling, and I hope I did you well.
Give me your address, and that way we can have a magazine sent to you.
Sure, it's 811.
All right.
18th Avenue South.
Okay.
Nashville 37203.
Real good.
All
well, Blake, thank you so much.
You bet.
Okay,
good
have
luck.
A good day. See you.
Bye. Bye-bye.